The prayers. We're starting out by, you know, we're talking about karma in this class, so let's start out by planting seeds. And these prayers are designed, we think of them as collecting and cleansing, collecting a lot of meritorious, virtuous karma, and cleansing the negative karma. So we'll, So we talked about the refuge one last time, the first two lines having to do with separating the Buddhists from the non-Buddhists, and within Buddhism, the last two lines, we're Mahayana Buddhists. We dedicate our practice to the benefit of all living beings. Then the second four measurables, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That's the statement that we call it universal love. But is it those words? May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That doesn't mean any. These are just words, aren't they? They don't really do it. They don't. If we don't connect to the meaning of the words, we might as well be going bibbidi bobbidi boo. You know, there's nothing. It's meaningless. So, to make these words come to life, we have to study the Dharma. Because we have to understand that everybody wants happiness and nobody wants to suffer. But we're all suffering. And so we can genuinely wish not only the loved ones and the people that we don't know and the ones that we're indifferent towards, but also the people that we have aversion toward. They're also all sentient beings. Uh-oh. You mean that person? We got to wish him or her happiness and the causes of happiness? Yep. That's universal. So that those words are meant to help evoke the feeling of love, then may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Well, that's the, by the way, we're part of all sentient beings, right? So that's the definition of compassion in Buddhism. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So, and again, we think of, well, the people that are inside the Beltline, they're not suffering because they're in the God realm. Or, you know, the people that have it made, the beautiful, handsome, wealthy, have a good reputation, or have a reputation anyway, that it's hard to have compassion for people that seem to be like really prospering. Sometimes we get jealous, but they're suffering. You know, all you have to do is pick up. Every time I walk through the grocery store to check out, I look at those tabloids. I go, ouch. It's just one thing after another. So may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. Our friends, strangers, and the people that we feel aversion toward. So that we want to generate heartfelt compassion. By the way, remember what I said about compassion last time? Anybody? I said a lot about compassion, but anybody remember what I said? So, if is it easy to develop compassion for your children, you know, somebody that you really feel close to, when they, gosh, I used to work in emergency rooms back in the day when I was just in the early days of my medical career. I can remember, seeing little kids come in, little babies come in with lacerations on their chin. And back in those days, we had to put them in a papoose. And the mother, when I would stick the needle in the baby to numb up the chin, the mother would almost pass out. And it was almost as if I was needling her. She felt such connection. So it's easy to have compassion for people we love. Now the people that we don't know, 43 people died. I don't know if it's true, but in a train accident in Ethiopia. Well, that's too bad. But we don't feel much, do we? You know, or I'm not even going to go there, but just billions of animals and human beings dying all the time, but we don't know them. So we don't feel any. We don't have any feeling of compassion to those people, those living beings that we feel indifference toward. And then you take the ones you don't like and you hear they're suffering and dying. What happens? We rejoice. We actually are excited. You know, when Saddam Hussein got killed, a lot of people were excited. And then, you know, so we've got to have feel a sense of connection to others for sincere compassion. And what we're trying to generate here in this center, and in, as people, and I'm not saying we're there by any stretch of the imagination, but we're trying to develop the attitude of universal responsibility, which requires these kinds of realizations, that it's not just for the ones that are near and dear, but it's for all living beings. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. I never have completely understood that, but it actually has to do with joy. We're wishing all beings joy, which is different than love and compassion. We're just wishing them joy. And again, not for just the ones that are near and dear. And then the last one, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So we go back to the beginning of, goes back to the whole thing on compassion. Without equanimity, it's impossible to get enlightened for all beings, or to even to want to help all beings. It's impossible as long as we're biased. The ones that are nice to me, that I label friends, but the ones that bother me or their behavior I find aversive, we put the label enemy. Big mistake. Guess what happens when we label somebody enemy? They come back again and again. If we hate somebody, if we genuinely hate or harm them, we create the causes for them to come back into our lives again. And it perpetuates the cycle of hatred, perpetuates the cycle of suffering. So we definitely need these four measurables. All right, so we'll do these two prayers, and then we'll go all the way through the mandala offering. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. By the way, you go for the attitude that you should have when you go for refuge is there are three things. I don't know if I talked about them. The first one three things. The first one is fear. We don't like that word fear, do we? But so we can use other words like dread. Alex Berzin likes the word dread. Fear sounds so heavy, but what it is dread or fear of what it would be like to go through the rest of our lives with a mind that's completely out of control. You know, and that's our mind, completely out of, I mean, we have moments, right? But basically, you know, we're caught up in a process of uncontrolled causation. Things are coming into our lives. We have no control over what we experience. And then we don't have any control over what we think in the moment we think it. And the next moment, we do have control. But in that moment, our karma forces us to see certain things a certain way, just how it is. Now, what we do in the next moment determines our future. So, anyway. So, this dread of having to live our lives out with a mind that's out of control. So, we want somebody to teach us how to control our mind and to take control of our future so we can create the causes for bliss, to literally live in a paradise. Who wants to live in a paradise? I do. We all do. We all want to be happy all the time. We don't want to suffer. So we got to have, because of dread of having to live with this mind that's completely wild, and out of faith, and again, this is not for the newbies here. What I'm saying, I would not expect you to have faith in the Dharma, in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, in the three jewels. Because you haven't practiced. Those of us who've been doing this, and I'm up on my 41st year of practicing Tibetan Buddhism, or at least I do everything. I've been all over the place: Japan, Thailand, Sri Lanka. I love it all, but my home is bodhicitta, the Mahayana motivation. I love that. So faith is a big part of it, and this certain part, it's not totally blind faith, but remember, we can learn things three ways. We can learn them through direct perception. We can learn them through what else? Reasoning, right? We learn a lot of things through reasoning, and then we learn it through scripture. And in the case of karma, teachings on karma and the Buddha, we're really depending on him, because there's so many aspects of karma that are hidden. We don't understand the true deep meaning of karma, so we can know things different ways, but we have to have some faith. So I recommended at the first class that everyone creatively align, or at least take the hypothesis. That's even a better word. That's a better scientific term. Take the hypothesis that what the Buddha's teaching on karma is really the truth. Now, a good scientist, when you get a hypothesis, what do? You go out and try to find data to prove the hypothesis. And when you can't find that data, then you can throw it out. But we're taking the hypothesis that these really are the valid teachings of the Buddha. So this dread of this kind of mind, faith, or confidence. A lot of people like to water that word down with confidence, but that's fine. And then last is compassion. Compassion for ourselves, compassion for all living beings. Those are the three reasons that we take refuge, okay? Because we're looking for somebody or something that can guide us from this state of whatever your mind is right now to something that's really extraordinary. And it may not work for everybody, right? It's just like I give medicine out all day. It's really disappointing when I give them my favorite drug and they don't get better. I go, well, guess you didn't have the karma to get better from that drug. Got to try a new one. So this may not be your medicine. Tibetan Buddha Dharma may not be your medicine, and it's just fine. It's okay to, you know, go find your medicine somewhere else. Okay. But anyway, that's why we take refuge. Four measurables. Let's say that again. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free for attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined, clear all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence. Turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And then, the mandala offering. This is one of those ritual things that Buddhists do. Sometimes if you have a mala or a rosary or something, you just use this as kind of a little tool to help you imagine that I'm offering like a universe of everything. I mean, I want these teachings so bad. I'm willing to offer a universe of jewels and everything that's wonderful. I'm willing to offer it to be able to get the teachings, get the guidance that I need to transform my mind and from its state of perpetual confusion and grasping and never satisfied to perfect bliss of full enlightenment. You know, so I'm willing to offer that. That's the attitude. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radha Mandala Kam Niryata Yami. Which means I send forth this jewel mandala to you precious teachers, gurus. Okay. I thought I was taking a really good medicine. I was feeling so much better. Now it's not working. It's just like I was talking about. It doesn't work for everybody. But we'll see. Maybe I'll make a comeback. So what meditation did I ask people to do last week? Anybody remember? I mean, we had handouts. To be sure. Anybody want to tell me what those four aspects of karma are? I'm going to write them down. I mean, there's some things in this class that you need to remember. This is one of those things that you need to remember. The four laws of karma.
You got it. Karma is definite.
And tell me what that means.
That whatever action you did, that there is going to be some other reaction that's going to follow that. And it can be good or bad depending on what the previous action or the dependent arising it was.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm hearing what you say, but say it another way.
Say it another way.
Well, I'm going to say it another way. All right. Virtuous actions. Now, what constitutes a virtuous action? Because that's what we need. That's what's going to cause us to be happy, right? So we need to know what they are. We can't just be throwing terms around here. What's a virtuous action?
One that
brings
happiness. Pardon? One that brings happiness.
To who? Yeah. An action that we perform that brings us future happiness is called virtue. So if I want the future to be happy, then I have to plant what kind of seed? Will a grape seed grow an oak tree? No. Seeds of virtue, I'm going to use this, seeds of virtue, I'm going to say, lead to happiness. Something like that. And seeds of non-virtue. Now, what's non-virtue?
An action that either brings you suffering or others suffering.
Specifically, we define it as brings us suffering in the future. Because we're the one doing the action.
Ah.
I mean, it could make others suffer for sure, but it's going to make us, it's going to make me suffer. So an action that I perform that's going to, non-virtue is an action that will cause me to suffer in the future. I might take a lot of people down with me, but that'll be their karma. All right? So it leads to suffering. All right. Law number two, we need somebody else to speak up here.
Karma multiplies.
All right.
Expands. Grows.
It expands. It increases. I had a moment this week where I thought one karmic seed, could that become like thousands of karmic seeds? And that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about one karmic seed, just like a little acorn, becoming an oak tree. It expands, but it expands exponentially. Right?
A small action, like we have a lot of harmful things that come up in the news, but somebody kills somebody else. It's not just between them; it's the family that suffer and the law enforcement that had to go. Like it's a really big.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the action. There's so much more involved in it that I don't know.
Right.
Kind of blows my mind. But
so this is. Let me go back over here and say this too, that. If somebody else kills somebody and we rejoice in them killing, in that killing, guess what? We get the karma of killing. Now, if somebody does something positive and we rejoice in that, we also get the good karma from that. And depending on a bodhisattva, who's a really highly realized being, will get the same or more karma than the person who did the virtuous action when they rejoice. So they always say one of the easiest ways to increase your good karma is to rejoice. Just walk around, walk around thinking, hey, everybody's driving safe today. Isn't that cool? The roads are good. The roads are working. Electricity comes on. Just, you can come up with silly things, but rejoicing is a way to increase that karma too. So karma expands and increases. So even the tiniest little action of kindness eventually can ripen into like us winning the lot, or generosity, say, for example. You give a quarter to a beggar, but it's, you really do it with sincere good heart, you down the road could win the lottery. Like in 6 months you win the lottery, you go, wonder what I did to win the lottery. And you, oh yeah, remember I gave the quarter to the beggar. I mean, karma works like that. That may be a little bit of an exaggeration, but you get the point. And so even little smiles, kindnesses, just things you, when you're standing in line in the grocery store or in an elevator where everybody's, staring at each other, looking at the wall, ignoring each other. There's ways that we can plant little karmic seeds because we understand that it expands. So we don't ever want to miss the opportunity to plant the positive karmic seeds. And when we do something negative, what do we want to do? ASAP? Pardon?
Purifying regret.
Say it again. What's the thing?
Regret. Purify.
Purify. We need to do it. We need to clean it up as quick as we can. So we don't want to. That's why I said at the end of the day, it's always good to go back over your day, review it, and then try to do some sort of purification practice, whether it be mantras or just a sincere prayer that, you know, I really regret this, and you know, I want to purify it. And there are definite practices for that in Buddhism. We'll talk about four opponents. We already have, but we'll do it again. A little repetition is not a bad thing, is it? All right, number three. All right, we need some volunteers here. Otherwise, I'm going to start pointing at people.
Oh, it's specific?
Pardon?
It's specific. You don't experience a result that you don't cause.
Okay. I mean, one of the ways, I've heard it said a lot of different ways, but you cannot experience a result that you didn't create the cause for, right? So, I don't know about, specific sounds good too, though. Cannot. This one is loaded. And when I say we, got to be careful here. Am I talking about you? You, the personality you?
No.
Not necessarily. It could have been something that you, or you're not even the same person. We're not even the same people we were when we walked in, right? But our mind is a continuity. So it could have been the continuity of your consciousness in this lifetime that was, you know, created the causes to experience like something really good or something really bad. So, but when we talk about we, we're also talking about the continuity of this mind in former lifetimes. You know, it's like use the example of the Nile River and how it weaves its way through Africa, and in every country it has a different name. It's the same river, it's the same continuity, but it has different names. And same way that our mind is a continuity, consciousness constantly changing, but it's the same stream of consciousness. So when we experience a result of, like, we use some of the shocking examples of somebody coming in here and blowing us all away, you know, if we bought into this, we would go, hey, we collectively, all of us, must have killed somebody, most likely the person who's come back in, who's killing us at some former life, in some former lifetime. And so now this is karmic boomerang. I forgot my boomerang again, by the way. But it's a way to think where if everybody talks about taking responsibility, this one's about being responsible. We are 100% responsible for everything that has ever happened to us in this lifetime, according to the laws of karma. We cannot experience a result. We did not create the cause for. Now, does this mean blame? Does this mean we're to blame? Being responsible for something is not the same thing as blame, is it? You get what I'm saying? If we experience a result, we, you know, there's a tendency to think that you know, to go blame rather than responsibility. And blame has a negative connotation, you know, like you were bad or wrong. And so it's not the same thing. Now, four is what? Pardon?
Never lost.
So karmic seeds are never lost. So there's a fancy word for karmic seeds. I'm going to use it a little bit tonight. It's called bok choks. I think this is Sanskrit, or it could be Tibetan. Bok choks. These karmic seeds are never lost. Now, right now, I was just commenting that, well, until they ripen, okay? So once the karma ripens, it's finished. And so it can't bring any more fruit. I mean, once you cut the tree down, it's gone. So they're never lost until they ripen, until the cooperative conditions come together for a karma to ripen. And then once it has, it's finished. It's kind of like a form of purification. That's why I was commenting a minute ago that I was not feeling not great. And I'm going, yeah, this is, you know, I joke with Watkins all the time whenever, you know, he's sick or whatever. We go, gosh, such great purification, you know. We're getting rid of this karma, because if this karma didn't ripen as a cold, today it could ripen as a cancer in a year or two or five or ten, whatever. So karmic seeds are never lost but they can eventually ripen, or they can be purified. We have the 400 powers for purification, right? Talked about those, because we want, otherwise nobody wants to hear about this unless there's a way to get out of it. I mean, this is the whole point. Is to escape suffering. So I'm going to erase this. I'm putting the stuff that I think is the most important, but the most important stuff is actually coming later tonight and then next week. But these are the things that you really need to know. So four opponents. We call them different terms, four opponent powers. All right, number one, what is it? All right, refuge. Now, what does that mean? This is a hard one to explain, but then maybe not so hard. We go back, if we're Buddhist, now if you're not Buddhist, This is not going to work for you. But as Buddhists, we go back to basically our spiritual roots, what we have faith in. And so the things that we take refuge in are they so-called the three jewels, the Buddha, the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which equal emptiness. That's really what that's about. We take refuge in the three jewels and bodhicitta, this great compassion for all sentient beings. So that's kind of the ground that this practice of purification starts on, is to have some kind of faith in refuge and our potential to become enlightened as bodhisattvas. So the second one is what?
Regret.
We'll keep it in the R's. It's easier to remember that way. Regret. All right. So that's pretty straightforward, isn't it? But we don't tend to we have to be brutally honest with ourselves, because a lot of us have Well, as George Dreyfus said, I mentioned this one of the first classes, he was the first Westerner to ever get like the degree as a Tibetan Geshe, but there are different levels of degrees, and like Geshe Gelug has a lot, it's like magna cum laude, right? Summa cum laude. Yeah. So, Larumpa Geshe. So George Dreyfus, who was from Switzerland, taught himself how to speak Tibetan. He was a genius. Very, very smart guy. George came here in the late 1980s, early, about circa 1990, before Kadampa Center was officially together. And he mentioned, we have enormous potential for self-deception. So we really have to be honest, brutally honest with ourselves. Did we do something negative? Did we do something negative? And not justify it away or, well, I did it because this or that. But be honest. So this requires sincere honesty. And as much as you can, try to remember in as much detail as you can about the things that you regret. Because this is the beginning of letting it go. So we've got to start there. Now, what's the third one? Pardon?
Remedy.
The remedy. I like, some people put the fourth one here, but remedy. Is that R-E-M-E-D-Y? Yeah. So that can start out as an apology. It can start out, it can be, I mean, in Buddhism, the traditional practices, but, you know, it basically, you can do like Bodhisattva mantras, you can do visualization practices, you can meditate on emptiness, you can meditate on compassion. Again, you can apologize to people. You can, Lama Zopa says, most, you know, very, very powerful way is to go out and do something and work for others. Do something meaningful for others. It's a great way to help purify the negative karma that we've created, that we're trying to purify. And then the fourth one, which is the most important one, is what?
Resolve.
Resolve. All right. And why is that so important? Why is that important?
You don't want to do it again.
Well, yeah. What would it, forget about resolve and just, if we left it at the first three, without that resolve, wouldn't be very effective, would it?
Right.
Because we could turn right around, well, we did such and such today, let's purify it, then tomorrow we'll do it again. It's, in fact, somebody, a psychologist called one time was calling some, you know, these, for example, these, and they use, again, I'm using some extreme examples, but these people that abuse children, for example, parents, and will abuse their children, and they'll feel, oh, I'm so sorry, I'll never do it again, I really regret I did it. But they turn right around and do the same thing over again. And they turn around and do it again. And again. And again. The cycle of abuse. Because there's no resolution to stop doing it. So the resolution is what puts teeth in these four opponent powers. And so we don't want to lie about it, do we? So for example, if you're somebody that's prone to anger, or attachment, or lust, or whatever you want to work with your major delusions first, of course. But let's say you're purifying something that has to do with anger, and you're prone to anger. You might want to say, "Hey, I'm promising as best I can not to get angry for." What do you think? 5 minutes. That would be a good start, wouldn't it? Now, you might have to go into another room and get away from people. Because, you know, that, which is a skillful way, by the way, of not, you know, letting a negative, you know, when karma ripens, you have to have a cooperative cause. So if the cooperative cause is your ex-husband or ex-wife, better to stay away if you want to stay calm for 5 minutes. So the resolve could be for a minute or 5 minutes. It could be for as long as you can sincerely keep it. You want to keep it. And then you can come up with a new resolution after that, and a new one. Again, we talked about in a lot of these recovery programs, it's like I take it one day at a time. Just one day at a time. Today, I'm not going to drink. Today, I'm not going to use that drug. Today, I'm going to stay clean. So this, you know, this will show up again and again and again and again. If you can do this at night before you go to bed, take, you know, inventory of things that you've done that you don't like. That you go, wow, I wish I hadn't done that. You know, usually it has a little negative charge with it. Could have been something you did mentally, like thoughts. The heaviest karma is the ones of body. So killing, stealing, and adultery. The next heaviest are the ones of speech, lying, slander, harsh, and frivolous talk. And then there are the three of mind, but there's many, many more, but we call it ill will, attachment, and ignorance. So we try to remember what we've done that day that has been out of line, and then we sincerely regret it. Then we can do some prayers, some traditional prayers like Vajrasattva mantra, or promise to do 200 hours of community service. That'd be a good one. And then you make your resolution. I'll promise not to do this again for a certain period of time. So this is something that needs to be in your memory. You remember any questions about any of this? Any questions about the other stuff? Yeah, go ahead.
Can you purify karma from past lives?
Oh, absolutely. That's the whole point. We've done everything.
Yes.
We've killed. We've stolen. We've committed adultery. We've lied. We've slandered. Countless times. So we have bazillions of karmic seeds. We say, well, I didn't do that in this life, but we've done it. And the Buddhist perspective is we've done it all countless times. And so we want to purify not only the karma of this life, but all of our former lifetimes. Because remember, karma is never lost. So when the cooperative cause, there's a seed for you to be killed, and you go to Afghanistan, there's a better than average one. I don't know what the chances are, but you could be killed in Afghanistan. You could be killed anywhere. You could be killed on I-40. But that's So we definitely want to purify karma from this and all of our previous lifetimes. Be thinking that way. Think big. The other thing is, in terms of the remedy, the ultimate remedy is meditation on emptiness. Because until we have a direct insight, intuitive insight into emptiness, even though we do these four opponent powers, we can only weaken the power of the negative bakchak, the negative seed. We can't completely eradicate it until we have this realization of emptiness. So they say in the scripture that, for example, once you start purification, watch out, because all kinds of bad things are going to happen to you. As weird as that sounds, because we're the heaviness of the negative karma is decreasing, so a lot of little annoying things are going to start happening. Just get ready for it. because that's part of the purification process. Doesn't sound that tasty, but that's what the scriptures say. So meditation on emptiness is the ultimate remedy.
Don, we have another question back here.
Yeah.
Can you confirm what you were saying about the back to the aspects of karma, the first one where it's, you said it was definite? We're talking about the like your actions producing your future happiness or suffering, not like the effect of other people's action.
Say that again.
You said karma is definite, but it's more pertaining to you, not really the effects of how you're affecting other people or other people affecting you.
No,
it's more about your
action. It's your karma,
okay.
So how it affects you.
Okay, so it's... Okay.
So if it causes you to suffer, it was negative. If it causes you to be happy, it's positive. So let me go through the 10 non-virtues here, just for the fun of it. Because this is crucial too. These are some of the things that you need to memorize. Non-virtues. So the three of body, the heaviest of all, is killing. Nobody wants to die. Nobody wants to die. Everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. And so taking a life, and we try, although we're having a problem with cockroaches in the kitchen right now, we're doing our best effort to get those dudes out of there without killing them. Not easy. I have a bugzooka at home. Anybody know what that is? Really? I love my bugzooka. We always go around and we find these spiders, these daddy long legs, and we hit the button and poof, they get sucked in this little compartment. And then the girls and I take them outside and liberate them in the middle of the night. So we try not to kill, right? So what's the opposite of killing?
Saving lives.
Saving lives. But these are the 10 non-virtues. The actual... This is weird, because, and I may have a little bit of trouble explaining this. Maybe because I'm not that clear. But you can't practice the virtue of non-killing until you're confronted with an opportunity to kill. In other words, and then you restrain yourself. That's called practicing. That's practicing the virtue of non-killing. So whenever we are in a situation where we could kill and we choose not to kill, that's a positive action. That's a positive. And also saving lives is another form of that. But avoiding, you know, when we're confronted with an opportunity to kill, we don't kill. All right, the same thing is, so these are three of the bodies, stealing. Taking that which is not freely given. Okay? So, by the way, what do you think the karmic result of killing is? Several of them.
To be killed.
To be killed. But also, what else?
Short life.
Pardon? Short
life.
Your life could be shortened.
Lower rebirth.
Lower rebirth.
And you want to kill.
And the tendency to kill. Yeah. Perfect. Everybody's been reading this stuff. Exactly. So same thing with stealing. If we steal, what are the karmic consequences of stealing? I can't remember where you're going to be. You know, it'll be a lower rebirth. We know that much. The heavier the karma, the lower the rebirth, the more suffering in the next lifetime. But what else? What's the obvious one?
People
are going to steal from us. So next time, you know, you get ripped off. I was talking to somebody today when I started in my started in my the business I'm in now, the medical business. I had one lady who did everything, and because there were just two of us and no patients, so we didn't have much to do. When we get one or two, would come dribbling in. Well, over time, money started coming in, and a friend of mine who has a similar business, he said, Brown, you got your head in the sand. You don't pay attention to the business. She could be stealing you blind. Guess what? She was. She was stealing from me. I didn't know it because I just trusted, but not, you know, I didn't check behind her. And I felt so violated by that. And then I go, well, wait a minute. I must have stolen from somebody else. This is karma coming back around. That boomerang is coming back around. So I don't get to be a victim here. I want to be, but according to karma, it's just the fruition. So people are going to rip us off. We're going to have a tendency to steal again, right? And what else? And a tendency similar to the cause and action. Yeah, those are the two big ones. And then a bad rebirth. And then the third one is an environmental result, which would be a lousy environment. Okay? Those are the three of that. Those are the karmic fruit of that. Then we've got adultery. That's a loaded term, isn't it? How do you spell it? A-R-Y? That's close enough. So Buddhism defines... Buddhism not all that doesn't make a big deal about sex, really. It just says having, I don't know what, you know, I've heard, just harmful sexual relations. In other words, if you lead somebody on, it's going to hurt some, it's going to harm another living being. Not only give them, you know, make them pregnant when they don't want to be pregnant, or give them a disease when they don't want a disease, or play with their emotions, or, you know, usually adultery, which means is strictly defined as having sexual relations with someone else's partner. But it's much bigger than that. It's anything that harms using intimacy to, you know, to harm another person. That's what that boils down to. And so what does that create the cause for? Lousy relationships. So if you have lousy relationships and having trouble making and keeping friends, you got to be very sort of careful about your sexuality and how you use that. Also, people are going to cheat on you, right? And then you're going to get a lower rebirth, and then you're going to live in a nasty place. I can't remember what kind it was, but there's a whole list of environmental results too. All right, so those are the three of the three of body. These are the three easiest to do, right? Because it's easier to control our body and our speech than our mind. So just remember that. I mean, keep your hands to yourself and your mouth shut is Robina Corton's advice to us. So there's the three of body. Four of speech. Lying obviously creates the cause for us to lie, have a tendency to lie, and have people lie to us. And then that's also not a good rebirth. Slander. That's when you talk and you're trying to divide, you know, have people not, like you're bad-mouthing somebody, trying to turn somebody against somebody else. But it creates the causes for people to bad-mouth us, right? And for us to have terrible relationships. Nobody trusts us because, you know, my gosh, if she talks about me the way she's talking about him behind my back, you know, we're in trouble. I don't want to be a friend of that person. So slander is bad news. Then we've got harsh speech. And this is everything from yelling to, you know, it's not just four-letter words, but it's just kind of speech that people find offensive, and nobody wants to hear it. And it also creates the causes for people to yell at us. If you don't want to get yelled at, don't yell at other people. The easy fix. Okay? So there's a tendency to do it, and then for it to come back to us in the form of others yelling at us. And seven is, sometimes it's written as gossip, frivolous speech. But guess what the karmic result of gossip and frivolous speech is? But now?
They gossip about you.
They'll probably gossip about me, but that's getting back, that sounds more like slander. But guess what happens when you talk? Nobody's going to listen to you. Nobody. Do you remember Amy? In the Venerable Amy? actually, she was talking about lying. But if we gossip and we let our mouths run on and on and on just to fill up dead space, then pretty soon nobody wants to listen to us. And then we have the habit in the next life to do it. And again, we're also reborn in a joyless realm. All right, and we got, all right, that's the four, yep, four of speech. And then there's the three, whoops, let's sit down here. By the way, if I had to, every time I think about karma, these things I can remember. Because these are things that we all, those of you who are serious about Buddha Dharma and you want to, and you're serious about trying to live in accordance with the laws of karma, these are important lists to commit to your memory. 8, 9, 10. And there's a lot of different, this is just my version of it. But sometimes this is ill will, which sounds a lot like hatred, okay? Aversion. Similar, wouldn't you say? The mind of aversion, ill will, hatred. So that, again, we're going from the heaviest to the lightest, but these three of them, of mind, they're the hardest because we can't control our mind yet. It's completely out of control. By the way, let me do the other one. All right, so this one, next one is like, sometimes I've seen it translated as craving or attachment. Now, there are good kinds of attachment and the bad kinds of attachment, but the attachment that we're talking about here is when we distort the reality of something, we exaggerate its desirable qualities, and then we've got a habit. That's the one that gets us in trouble. So craving and attachment, and then ignorance. And ignorance, ignorance is defined lots of different ways too, but the big ignorance, the big ignorance with an I, is misknowledge of reality. It's like we don't understand emptiness. We don't understand the truth of emptiness, which is the most important thing of all the things we could learn in this life that could liberate us, that could help us stop our suffering, and actually breathe life into these teachings on karma, would be to understand the truth of reality. The wisdom of emptiness is what we call it. Shunyata is a Sanskrit word. But ignorance also is like not believe, it's called, sometimes we say disbelief in the laws of karma. And again, for those of us that are new to this, it's healthy to have doubts about it all. Okay, I'm not saying You have to buy it. But that's considered a form of emptiness, ignorance, because the Buddha, out of his compassion, he saw, the Buddha was the omniscient one. He saw that the long-term consequences of all of these actions was suffering. So ignorance is disbelief in the laws of karma, disbelief in future lives, disbelief in your potential, in your, in each of our individual potentials to achieve nirvana and Buddhahood. We have, you know, we have such a, what I call, a spiritual inferiority complex. We don't think we have, we don't think that we have what it takes to be truly happy. We think we're this story that we've made up about ourselves, and then we've invested our whole lives, and we believe that that story is real because it talks about me, the real me, which in fact is a fabricated me. It's the one projected by ignorance. All the stories are made up about a me that doesn't exist in reality. We do exist, but not that one. Not the way we think we do. So all of that, all of the stuff that we make up about ourselves is self-destructive, is based on ignorance. So these are the hard ones. The hardest to do. The heaviest to the hardest. And of course each one of these has their own, for example, I remember a few years back, not so much anymore, because they've written books on this. Remember, there was a time in the 80s and 90s when there was a big, like, let's get it out. You know, if you get angry, you know, let it out. And what they found was it just helped build up the habit of anger, didn't it? Turned out, I mean, it might have done some people some good, because there's some adrenaline that comes along with it. But it also, nobody wants to be around people like that. Nobody wants to be around somebody that's angry. Even animals don't even want to be around. They pick up on the vibe and they want to move away. So it just creates the habit to be the, we cultivate, if we cultivate aversion, not only we have a tendency toward aversion, but also the tendency for people to feel that way toward us. In the same way with this craving attachment, it creates the tendency to have more of that in the future and to attract people into our lives that have the same delusions that we do. Not necessarily helpful and so on. So you get this? It's very straightforward, but it's so, so important that we touch on these things, because this is, I mean, from my perspective, this is the real juicy stuff. I'm going to leave this up here for a while because we're going to do a meditation, and I haven't figured out how to do it yet, but we're going to on purification meditation. All right, so any questions up until right now?
Hi. So in scientific research, to find treatment for human diseases, scientists use animals like mice, zebrafish, frog, bacteria, and in the process you kill them. How would non-virtue action number one fit into that?
Very good question. Now you have to answer it. What do you think?
I think I remember something about the intention, motivation.
Yeah. So there was, so we were going to talk about euthanasia and abortion and break into small groups, but we don't have time for that one. That would take all night. But remember that for a karmic action, for a complete karmic action, you've got to have number one, is the intention, right? That's the key. That's the most important one. And remember what I said about we have a tremendous ability to deceive ourselves. So we have to be careful. We can say, oh, well, I did it for the right reasons. But maybe not. So we have to question our intention. But that has to be this. So if you're killing an animal in a lab to try to find the cure for AIDS, your intention might be very pure. But then again, if you had a vow to not kill, for example, you might actually look for another way to get that information without killing the rat. Right? There might be other ways to get to that information. The first one was intention. Then you had to have the object. Right? So, you know, I had a dog one time, and his name was Yeshi, and named him after Lama Yeshi. And I gave him to a friend, and I asked him to promise me he'd let him die naturally, because I didn't want to kill him. I thought he should just die naturally, but I think he put him down to come. He didn't tell me, but anyway, but he was suffering. She was suffering a lot. She was sick. And she couldn't get around, and I thought, you know, maybe if we could just keep her comfortable, but whatever happened, happened. But I must say, his intention was compassionate, and the object was my dog. I gave him the dog, but it was my dog. And then the result, wait a minute now, the action, which is taking the life of the dog, or the rat in the lab, or the maybe even worms, you know, little tiny bacteria and different things, the action, and then finally it's rejoicing, having no remorse at all about having done it. So if, for example, your intention is to come up with a cure for cancer, and the object is a mouse, and the action is killing, and you didn't rejoice, it's a karma gets created, doesn't it? It does get created, but it's not a complete karmic action. It's not a karmic action that will project a whole new lifetime. But it is one of those, remember we talked about the throwing karma and the completing karma. The throwing karma gives us a lifetime as a human being if we practice like morality. And then the details of that lifetime are filled in by the completing karma. So this is one of those karmic seeds that would fill in the experiences of a lifetime. So again, if your intention is, and how you kill somebody, like if you kill them, unmercifully, like you torture them to death, that's much heavier. And then the objects of our positive and negative actions are huge. The most powerful objects of our, this is what I tell my kids all the time, but they don't buy it. I say, look, you need to be, the people you need to be kindest to and most respectful to are me and your mom and your teachers. And that's, in Buddhism we say, you know, our, like Geshe Gelug, I mean, you know, our Dharma teachers, the people that are teaching us how to stop our suffering and find happiness. So the heaviest karma is with our parents and our teachers. Talking about a heavy object. So you harm them, big negative consequences. And being kind to them, big positive consequences. So the heaviness of the karma has affected by many things as well. But you can see, if your intention was undeceptive, we're not deceiving ourselves, we're not just doing it for me, but we're doing it because it is, you know, the best I can, you know, based on the knowledge I have now, this is the only way we're going to get the cure to cancer, is to take these rats and fill them full of this and fill them full of that, and then we're going to have to sacrifice them and do autopsies and try to learn. Okay? So your intention truly is that, then the object is the rat, and the rat dies, but you don't rejoice. So again, same thing. So it's not a complete karma, but yes, it's negative. And yes, it's going to cause you to suffer. But not as much as if it were a complete karma. And I will say this about abortion, just because Lama Yeshe, it always comes up. And, you know, it's, you know, and men and women are involved too. It's not just the women. And so, and when I first met Lama Yeshe, there were three or four women. There was like six of us, and we were talking to him. And he was, you know, he understands this. And he said, he asked these as soon as these women, when Lama Zopa was talking about, now this is going to start a firestorm, I'm sure, but I'll just say it. When Lama Zopa was talking about birth begins the moment of conception from a Buddhist perspective. So as soon, the moment the sperm and egg meet, the consciousness joins. And so now you have a living being. We use the word sentient being, but nobody uses the word sentient. We have a living being. So at that moment of conception, there's a living being. And then, of course, it's like an acorn. It can grow into a full grown human being. But then for whatever reason, for whoever it is to have, you know, the abortion, and three of these women had had abortions, and they were just so distraught, you know, talked to Lama Yeshe, and, you know, gosh, it looks like I've killed a baby, because it is a potential baby. I mean, it's a baby, but we don't call it a baby. We call it a morulus when it's a bunch of cells, and then it becomes a fetus, and then it, you know, we don't like to use baby, but it is a baby. But they felt terrible about it. And when they asked Lama Yeshe about it, he said, you know, there's definitely some karmic consequences there. I mean, there's karma planted that's not healthy. Now I don't know what the motivation was, but you could certainly see the action was that something died, right? So it wasn't a complete. So even if their motivation, if they thought that, if they were sincerely motivated by compassion, it's touchy. So Lama Yeshe said, he said, look, it's good that you can see this, but what's really good about it is you can purify it. You can go forward. You can move beyond that. Because it was plaguing these women. It was in their head. It was in their heart. It was something that they couldn't let go of. And he said, through doing Buddhist purification practices, you can let go of it. And you can move on. You can actually become an arhat and a Buddha. It's all possible. So it really comes down to being honest about what we've done that's been harmful and what we've done that's harmed others, and as much as we can, regret it, and then try to purify it. Does that make any sense? Yeah. It's not black and white. It really is not black and white. The key aspect of karma is intention. The key aspect of karma is intention. And we have enormous potential for self-deception until we become selfless, which is going to be a long way away. Before, until we realize emptiness, we have to be very, very careful and check on our motivation as much as possible, our intention. Anyway, those women were actually left that conversation feeling hopeful. They didn't feel shamed at all. They felt like, hey, there's something I can do now to let go of that, and to weaken the force of that karma. Okay, so now we're coming down the wire. So let's bring to mind, let's do a little meditation on the characteristics of, no, let's do purification. All right. So start out by watching your breath. This first step is in the three R's. Remember, there's refuge, regret, the remedy, and then the resolve. So think of some, maybe one or two or three things that when you think about it, there's like a negative charge that's kind of in your heart, something that you go, ouch, I really wish I'd never done that. And now let's, and we'll start out with the refuge, which is, for those of you who are not Buddhist, I'll try to speak about it in a way that is universal. And it's really taking refuge in our own potential. Our own potential to, we all have, nobody here would say, I've never been compassionate, I've never been kind, I've never been humble, I've never been helpful or said the right thing at the right time to help somebody. We all have done those things to some little degree. We all have some seeds of virtue in our mental continuum. We all have that potential. And then from the Mahayana Buddhist perspective, you know, we're dealing with everybody on the planet. We're dealing even every living being, and the human beings, we're just a small part of it. There's the fish, and there's all the animals and insects and different living beings that are countless. And as crazy as it sounds, what we want to generate is compassion for all the universal living beings, and want, because they have Buddha nature, guide them from whatever state of confusion they're in to full enlightenment. You know, that's like the, what's called universal compassion. The Dalai Lama uses that term, universal compassion. So that's what we're taking refuge, is our potential, you know, emptiness, and this universe, this notion of universal compassion. This is the ground we're going to stand on as we do these other three R's. And then the second one is regret. So you bring to mind things that you regret. I can remember I did a fairly long retreat one time in Sri Lanka on the side of a hill on a tea plantation for like months, and I used to write down every session. I'd write down things that I regretted, that I'd done, that I could remember, and I tried to, or maybe I didn't write them down, but I brought them to mind. Try to remember. And sincerely regret them. Not just say the words, but feel in your heart that you regret that action, whatever it was. It could be something you said, something you did, something you thought. And then the remedy, and we're gonna, there's a 100 syllable mantra, but it's too long. So what we're gonna do is a mantra Lama Yeshe used to do all the time, and it's Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. And so, it's Taya Ta Om Mune Mune Maha Mune Soha. You can think of all the Buddha's teachings are crystallized into these words. So, you can join me or not, but you can imagine in front of you is like a living presence of an enlightened being of the Buddha in whatever form you can visualize him or her in. And about a body length in front at the level of your forehead, completely made of light. And it's not like a statue. It's not like, it's like a hologram, but it's actually a living presence. And as we say the mantra, imagine that white light enters the crown of our head from the Buddha's crown, us purifying our negative karma of body, and then red light from the Buddha's throat to our throat, purifying negative karma of speech, and then blue light from the Buddha's heart entering our heart, purifying negative karma of mind. So try to do this visualization as we say the mantra together. Some of you know it, some of you don't. We'll do it 21 times. Taya ta om mune mune maha mune soa. 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 Tayata Om Mane Mane Maha Mane Soma. And now feel, because there's no karma too big, too negative that cannot be purified. So feel, again, we're using our imagination now, but we want to feel that our body, our speech, and our mind has been completely purified. All of our past negative karmas of body, speech, and mind. Not just this lifetime, but countless previous lifetimes. We're completely pure. And that the Buddha comes, imagine again, completely made of light, like a hologram, but comes to the crown of our head, facing in the same direction, and then dissolves into our body, and our body, speech, and mind becomes one, the body, speech, and mind of the Buddha, completely pure. And try to feel that this is actually happening. And that you are now pure. And then the last is to have some kind of come up with some kind of what is the word I used? Some period of time that you can avoid those negative actions of body. Maybe just pick one or two that are big for you, that are heavy for you, and come up with some time frame that you can keep. And then, again, this is one of the cool things about karma is that, you know, if we just did it for ourselves, the benefit of the karma would be that small. But if we did, again, we try to set our motivation at the beginning of any virtuous action that we're going to dedicate it to all living beings. So, again, imagine from your heart, light beams go out with, you know, the beneficial karmic effects of our meditations and our listening to the Dharma. And it goes out to universal living beings and benefits them, and whatever they want and need, they get. We're imagining that's all coming from our heart. Okay, so we're done for tonight. I covered a lot of material, but I didn't cover anything really. The real juicy stuff's next week, because I want to talk. Next week I want to talk about the marriage. Get ready for this. We're going to have a wedding. The marriage of karma and emptiness. We've talked about that. But karma does not make any sense without, it doesn't have any, it doesn't have much effect at all, understanding karma without understanding emptiness. So we're going to talk about how they work together to help us. And we've already talked about it, but we're going to go into a lot more detail next week about what is emptiness and how does karma play out on the screen of our mind, which is completely empty. And we talked about all those frames, like it's empty, there's nothing out there that you can find that exists independent of our mind, right? It's void. And the karma ripens, and we get these little digital bites, and it projects our reality. And that's our karma ripening. Billions of karmic seeds ripening all the time. So if we want to see ourselves as happy, it's enlightened self-interest to be kind, to be virtuous. It just makes sense, because that's how the world is organized. That's how it works. So, again, my job will be to try to convince you next week. But that's and this week, I would like you to do two things. One is pay attention, be mindful of the 10 non virtues. Really, remember the 3, the 4, and the 3. Be mindful of those, and when you do something wrong, pay attention to that, and then purify that either on the spot or later on in the day. And then do the purification practice, you know, do the 4, you know, the regret, you know, the refuge, regret, remedy, and then the resolve. Try to do those 4 things. So that'd be your homework meditation, would be that. But just during the day, just be mindful of the 10 non-virtuous actions as much as possible. Avoid them. Okay? Thank you.